What's up, everybody? This week I'm joined by Greg Gregory as we sit down and talk about a movie that made everybody question their life decision whenever they went above 50 mile an hour. The movie Speed. That and a whole lot more is to come on this week's episode of the 90s Podcast. Welcome to the show. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the 90s Podcast, right here in the Because of Me Network. Hope you're doing well this week, and I'm joined by Greg Gregory. Greg, how are you, brother?
Hey, man, doing good. It's good to be back.
And after a couple of real heartwarming episodes, it's time to get back to the nitty-gritty of some 90s enjoyment and some 90s action.
Yeah, I'd actually offer that this is partly sci-fi, but we'll get to that.
We'll get to that, okay.
You'll see, though.
We're here to talk about the movie Speed, but before we go ahead and get started, go check out becauseofmenetwork.com, go check out Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and don't forget to check out all of our places where we're located. Those are in the description. So if you listen to this on Apple Podcasts and you like Spotify, we're on Spotify and so on and so forth. All those links, like I said, are in our link tree in the description. Just go ahead and tap it or click it if you listen to it on computer, and you'll get there. So yes, indeed.
Or don't the kids say smash it, smash the like button?
Smash that like button and subscribe. Yeah. Hit the bell for notifications.
Yeah. Please and thank you. I'm a YouTuber. This is how I make my money. Thank you, bye.
No, I love everybody who does that, right? Because they're so desperate for new people to subscribe, right? And right. They've got to do it in the least desperate way possible.
Sure.
To make it sound like they're not begging. They're like, oh, you'll be an absolute legend if you do this. I'll give you a shout out. It's like, you won't.
I've seen the Aussie man. I like him. He does like observational stuff for like, he has like so many cuss words, but it's something like you effing failed or something. I can't remember what it's called, but it's pretty brutal. But he's actually the most kind that I've found about that. There's other ones where they like guilt you into it. It's like, oh, look at this pie chart. It says this many people percentage that watch my videos aren't subscribed. Oh, it's like, okay.
I see a lot of a lot of YouTube's designed for kids too, right? That are like, you know, and if you know what 2 + 2 = 4 is, hit that subscribe button now.
Yeah, right. Have you ever breathed? Hit like and comment.
Right, yeah. So with that in mind, if you are on YouTube, we are on YouTube, go ahead and smash the subscribe button for us as well.
another connotation too.
Yeah. Definitely.
So that's kind of funny, really, because you don't want to do that to it. Definitely.
Oh, goodness me. So yeah, enough with the shenaniganery for the moment, because we've got a lot of shenanigans coming up here in a minute.
Yes.
As we talk about one of the best action movies made in the 90s. That's not Bad Boys, and we're talking about Speed.
Yeah, man. It was a really unique idea.
Yes.
And I think that it ended up possibly challenging other people to be creative.
Yes.
And because the action, like good cop, bad cop, like if you look back for the past from that exact point in 1994, if you look back 2 or 3 decades, there's probably 15 good cop, bad cop, buddy cop type action thrillers. Like, so, I mean, this was kind of a breath of fresh air at the time, and I think it really fit well for the time that it came out.
I think the best Lethal Cop Buddy Car Chase movie that was out was Lethal Weapon, and I think after that, there was nothing really. I mean, they went on to spoof it in National Lampoon's Loaded Weapon, which I think is still one of the funniest movies ever. I don't care what anybody says.
I never saw that. I guess I can get another one. Every time we do this, I have to like write down a movie or a show or something. Yeah, it's awesome, man. It's keeping my brain.
It's got Samuel L. Jackson and Emilio Estevez in it as the characters that Bruce Willis and Danny Glover play. And if it's got Samuel L. Jackson, it's an immediate 5 stars for me. Because it's Samuel L. Jackson.
He's fantastic, absolutely.
Yes.
So I had Loaded Weapon, and then last week we were talking about the... Dumb and Dumber. We were talking about the movie where he... they caught up with them.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't need to be... We don't really need to go over it right now, but... It's on my list, so I'm gonna add that one right to it.
Well, there's another one I want to mention here in a minute, so you might want to, if you haven't seen it, you might want to get your pen back out. But
I'll have it ready.
Speed was an action thriller written by Graham Yost, directed by Jan de Bont, and produced by Mark Gordon, released by 20th Century Fox. It came out on the 6th of... I've been here for 20 years, Neil, and I still British read the dates. It came out the 10th of June, 1994.
Yeah, June 10th, yeah. So just, yeah, remember when it's American, you just start with the month. If I moved to Europe, I would never be able to go the other way. So I commend you for even... like having the wherewithal or like the understanding that you need to, yeah. So thanks, it's been ingrained in your brain, obviously. So.
20 years learning something, 20 years unlearning it and learning something
exactly.
else.
Exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, it came out the 10th of June and on a $30 million budget made $320 million in 1994 money.
Wow. So, as far as budgets go, it was a blockbuster. That's a massive, massive budget. If you adjust it for inflation, it'd probably be closer to $500 million.
$500 million profit. Yeah, that's about right. So,
as far as what they spent too. So, I mean, it's a ton of money now.
Oh yeah, I mean, but they got their investment back on $30 million. Definitely. Especially considering...
I was just gonna say, I wonder how much that was actor's salary, or just because there's a lot of explosions and stuff. Like a lot of them.
Yes. Well, the thing is that because the actors weren't the studio's first choice, which we'll get to here in a minute, they probably was able to command a lower fee.
So it probably had to just be the massive amount of stunts and pyrotechnics, and they needed like a whole fleet of cars and probably multiple buses.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that's just the stunt coordination and the crews and the safety, pyrotechnic people, firefighters. They probably had to have, you know, I'm sure most of it probably went just to that. So, wow. Yeah. Probably, that's a crazy budget.
Probably trying to take a playbook from Michael Bay and Jerry Bruckheimer.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I'm not one of the guys that hugely follows directors and producers and stuff like that, but this director-producer combination doesn't leap out at me in any way. So, I mean, to me, that tells me that they just had overall chemistry. Like, they had the right people in the right places and made a good product.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, Graham Yost, right, was looking to make a new movie, looking for a new idea, and his father mentioned a movie starring John Voight called Runaway Train. I don't know what that's about. I've never seen it, never heard of it before I did the research for this one. And he came up with the idea of planting a bomb on a bus. And the bomb would go off if the bus went over 20 miles an hour and have the bus drive around Dodger Stadium in New York.
Okay.
There would have been no elevator scene. There would have been no end of the movie train scene either. It would just be straight on the bus, which 2 hours set on a bus might not have been a good thing. There wouldn't have been nearly enough action. But there's a movie that I like called The Taking of Pelham 123 that was released in 1974. It's got Walter Matthau and what's his name? Shaw. I can't even remember his first name. The guy from Jaws who was Quint. Anyway, he's in there. He's in there, and it's a really, really good movie. It's really, really tense too, but it takes place entirely on a New York City subway car. So, you know, I can see where they were going with this. Nobody wants to see and sit this movie, but there have been movies that come out in the past that are action movies that did take place on modes of transportation. You know?
I remember like I know this is after this, but like, what was that Colin Farrell movie that was like entirely in a phone booth?
Yes. Imaginatively called Phone Booth.
Yeah. It's like, I wonder what it's going to be about.
Now, kids, a phone booth is where they used to have a payphone.
What's that? What's that? Elder John?
Right.
Enlighten us.
Some kids don't even know what a landline is, never mind a payphone. Which makes me feel old.
Or the floppy disk drive.
Yeah.
That's a funny one.
Somebody 3D printed the save button. No, yeah. That's a disk drive.
and they think you're kidding.
It's like you see these kids trying to work a rotary phone now. But then again, you know what? We laugh at this, right? I don't know how to use a blacksmith station.
That's fair. That's fair. Me either.
What was that? Okay. They began working on tweaking the script, which Joss Whedon was called in to help. So he did
A big name.
It's a big name. He did a lot of rewrites for it, but it's still giving writing credit to Graham Yost. So, there you go. Okay. The script was expanded to feature the opening elevator scene and the end of the movie subway train scene. So, that's good because those are two iconic scenes sandwiching the bus sequence.
Yeah.
Like, the bus sequence was a huge pile of meat, but the two pieces of bread surrounding it were really, really good, too, I thought.
Yeah. It kind of moved it into it, and, like, it gave you a really solid A and B story.
Yes.
Because you had what was happening in the bus, and then you had all the behind the scenes, like, you know, the various, without going too far ahead, all the various places they went. So, and they... It was centered around it, but they still had a little bit of relief here and there, setting-wise.
Yes.
And that created some exposition. It created a little suspense, too, I would offer.
Oh, yeah.
Because you know that situation is actively happening, and we're not watching it. Like, what if something, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop. So, yeah, I don't think this would have been successful if they'd have kept the original blueprint if they were going to do... I don't know if that would have...
Driving a bus 15 miles an hour around Dodger Stadium.
Yeah, the stakes aren't super high on that. I mean, there's the whole thing that they can't go below a certain speed limit, so that limits them to where they can maneuver and stuff. So it's just well thought out. I'm glad they went with the route that they did.
Well, not only that, the script was changed again when Keanu Reeves was cast, because he went from a wise-ass, slick, You know the kind of sleazy cop that they were trying to do, like they were trying to do Axel Foley.
Yeah, okay, that's what I was gonna say. Yeah. Like plays by his own rules. Yeah, a rogue cop. What's his name from Star Wars? Kind of like Han Solo.
Han Solo, yes.
And does his own thing. Yeah.
So they went for rewrote it as a concerned detective instead, which. You do see them doing detective work in this movie, which is really, really good. That's one of the things I don't like about a lot of movies, like about a lot of cop movies, is that they always go by their instincts and go to the next thing. They never do any detective work as the deducing why they should do the next thing.
Yeah, they just try to find who they can punch next, it seems like. totally.
But, Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock, who are the two main characters in this movie, weren't the studio's first choice.
That's crazy to me. These are so perfectly suited for both of those roles. I thought they did a great job. I think maybe somebody else could have too, but man, they just did a great job.
Well, you had Billy Baldwin, Tom Cruise, Wesley Snipes, and Woody Harrelson. I don't think Woody Harrelson would have done a good job. I think he's more suited to comedy.
Yeah,
I've always said that.
I think I don't know. Maybe Tom Cruise, maybe Wesley Snipes, but I don't know. Even though they shifted the script around to fit Keanu, it's just hard to imagine. It's such an iconic role. It's kind of just still hard to imagine anybody else there.
Right, and you know Wesley Snipes had just come off Demolition Man, too.
Yeah,
I mean that's
a big name. Those are all big names at the time.
I forgot to mention Tom Hanks too, but Tom Hanks was busy doing Forrest Gump.
Yeah. So that's the outlier. Absolutely. Took the words out of my mouth. Like, that's, you know what it is? That's like, I feel like every project or every idea is like, hey, this thing's got a ceiling somewhere. Let's see where it is.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks is your ceiling here because that's so far out in left field that it's gone up and created a ceiling. Well, so I'm just trying to imagine Tom Hanks like under a moving bus trying to, like, I don't. Okay, like right, I don't get it. I don't see it.
Don't get me started on Forrest Gump. I've been doing research for it for the season finale, and I got angry doing it. I mean, I got really, really mad. So
wow,
that's gonna be one to listen to. That's a fair bit away, but believe me when I say this, I'm not a fan of Forrest.
Okay,
so
wow.
We leave it at that.
He's like the Zach Morris of back then.
Kind of, it's more the writing of everything.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. So, well, I can't wait to hear that pod then.
Yes. Annie, who's Sandra Bullock's character, was going to be either Halle Berry, Ellen DeGeneres, or Anne Heche. Now, Ellen was a comedy actor at that point.
She was, yeah. I'm just trying to, just her the way she delivers. I'm just trying to imagine. It's like, oh, it's a bomb. Oh, there's a bomb. Ah, yeah, a bomb. Like, I don't know if that would.
Imagine putting Ellen with Dave Chappelle.
Yeah. Yeah, like, wow, that's crazy. But you know, honestly, that's top to bottom, that's actually a pretty fair little
group
selection of people. Yeah, that's pretty. That's like A and B list, top to bottom, right there.
And they plumped for Keanu Reeves, who was not who was best known for that time for
Bill.
Bill and Ted.
Bill and Ted, and
but the action movie that he did was Point Break.
Oh yeah, a surfing. It was him and Swayze, right?
Yes.
Yeah, rest in peace, man.
And then you had Sandra Bullock, who's famous for, as we mentioned, Demolition Man.
Yeah, with Wesley Snipes, right?
Yes, and yes. I love Demolition Man, and believe me, I want to cover it at some point.
Yeah, I've seen it. I need to rewatch it. I don't really remember much of it. I think I watched it on the road when I was exhausted.
One of the guys in there one of the cops in there is wasted. It's the bad guy from Shawshank, and I can never remember the actor's name, the warden from it. He's in a whole bunch of movies, but he's one of those guys in a whole bunch of movies, but you don't know his name.
Another character actor, yes. Yeah, like Chris Elliott.
Chris Elliott, yes.
One of those people you know his face and you're familiar with his work, but like gun to your head, you may not be able to pull his head name out of your, you know, yeah, whatever.
No, well, this movie, right, stars Keanu Reeves as Officer Jack Craven, Dennis Hopper as Howard Payne, who was the first choice and only choice to play the bad guy, which he is definitely a consummate evil actor.
Totally.
Like nobody else can. I mean, yeah, okay. He came off the Mario movie looking bad, and he came off Waterworld looking bad, but
yeah.
Both of those things, it was his performance that, you know, mwah.
His performance wasn't bad in either of those.
No.
So it's never been his fault on that one. I would offer he's like the dude from, what's that, Anthony Hopkins?
Yeah.
Just that whole, like, he's so creepy, like, he makes other, like, he literally scares other actors. Like, I was reading stuff about that. Like, other people will talk to him, and he'll slip into his Hannibal thing like that,
yes.
And they'll just be like, oh, man, it's so creepy, I'm literally shaking over here. He's one of those people. He's really had that creepy bad guy thing down.
Sir Anthony did that to Jim Carrey.
Yeah, that's who it was. Reading something about
came
that.
Came in for dinner, and Jim Carrey was like, he did the Hannibal thing all night, and it scared the out of me.
That sounds about right. Yeah, I couldn't remember who it was, but that's great that it was Jim Carrey, man.
That's that hometown sense of humor, see?
Yeah, the Canadian charm.
Because Annie Hopkins grew up like 9 doors down from where I used to live.
Really?
So, yes.
Oh, okay.
Same hometown.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Canada, where Jim Carrey's from there,
no,
for a second.
Jim Carrey's Canadian comedy is, I mean, he always pulls some of the great comedy, Canadian comedy artists with him, you know, as we mentioned during the Dumb and Dumber episode. And talking of Dumb and Dumber,
yeah.
Jeff Daniels is in this movie playing another guy called Harry.
Yeah.
Playing another guy called Harry.
And so this came out, this came out 6 months before Dumb and Dumber did. So.
Yes.
So they were probably finishing up Dumb and Dumber ish when this came out in the theaters. So yeah, it was pretty jarring. Like I mentioned that in the Dumb and Dumber episode, two episodes back, that it was really odd when the casting choice. It seemed that, you know, to see him in this serious role and then have him be thrusted right into this comedic duo road trip thing. Yeah. But I mean, the guy, he's super versatile, and he proved that he could do this because he absolutely hit it out of the park.
I'm sure he got paid decently for this one as well.
He probably got paid a lot more than he did for Dumb and Dumber after hearing the numbers. Because that's like a blue collar salary for a year. What he got paid,
Definitely. You know. A lot less than what you get a Hollywood actor. Supporting cast. Oh, sorry. We also mentioned Sandra Bullock stars as Annie Porter, as we mentioned. In her, some people say this is a breakout role, but I still think Demolition Man is.
Yeah, I think this is what solidified her.
Yes.
You know, she was already up and coming, but I think this is what okay, you're in, and then she did three or four huge movies directly after that. Do you remember The Net?
No.
That was her. I think that was the first one where she was like the star. It was called The Net, and it's kind of creepy too, man. It's tech kind of internet, like early internet, so it's really dated. Like, it's really dated, but some of it's made up, so yeah. Anyways, that's a good one to see if you're a fan of hers. And that was I think it was a year after this, roughly. So
there you go. Let's see. We've got Joe Morton playing Lieutenant McMahon.
Yeah.
Mac. Alan Ruck, Cameron from Ferris Bueller as Doug Stevens, tourist on the bus.
How did I not put that together until now? That's totally him. Whoa.
Yeah, because he was like, he was 35 when they did Ferris Bueller. So I know. He's in his 70s crazy? Now.
What? Pushing 50?
Alan Ruck? No, yeah, he's in his 70s now, definitely, because it was 35 years ago they did Ferris Bueller. And he was 35.
Oh, okay.
And he was 35 when they did it.
Oh, I thought you were talking about when they did Speed, when Speed came out. So yeah, okay. So he's probably in his 70s now, definitely.
Then you got Glenn Plummer, Beth Grant plays Miss Helen, who's another passenger on the bus, and Carrasco plays Ortiz, another important passenger on the bus. There's a lot of people on the bus, but these are the most important ones. The rest of them are just extras, for lack of a better term.
Right, bodies. Because some of them don't even have lines. There's a couple of them where they just react and move and maybe you go, but they they don't really have lines.
So. There you go. So let's dive into the plot real quick. We've got 4.5 pages of plot notes, so I'm going to try and get through this as quickly as possible, but there is a very dense movie for a movie set on a bus.
Sure.
And I mean that, I don't mean that in a negative way, because I mean, you know, it's a good movie. It is, you know.
Sure.
So in a downtown Los Angeles office building, a security guard is checking the basement where he runs across a man tinkering some wiring. As you can see, a work order man suddenly stabs the guard in the ear. That's a good way to start it.
Owie.
You know, up until I saw this movie, I didn't realize people would stab people in the head.
Dude, yeah. It just sounds like it would hurt and be hard to do.
Yes, so that's why it shocked me. Well, it shocked me because how violent it was, too, because, like, dang.
Right out of the gate, yeah, first 10 seconds in the movie.
And you instantly know who the bad guy is, you know? You don't need... Don't need no build-up, don't need no suspense. That's one thing I like about a lot of these movies, is that you know who the bad guy is within the first 5 minutes of the movie, and you don't need any big reveals, and, you know.
Don't need much exposition. He just shows his hand right in the beginning that shows he's evil. And you're like, him.
That's him.
Them.
Kick his ass.
Yeah,
know?
Get him.
So a group of people who work on the building are taking an express elevator down when a few explosions are heard. The cables are severed and the elevator plummets a few floors down before the emergency brakes kick in. So LAPD sent SWAT in, including hotshot officer Jack Traven and his partner Harry Temple. They join the team, and their boss, Mac, briefs them on the situation. Bombs have already severed the main cables we mentioned, and the only thing keeping the elevator from dropping to the basement is the emergency brakes, but the bomber has wired them with explosives and given them an hour to give him $3.7 million, or he blows the brakes.
Mm.
Now, why not just go for $4
million? I don't know. He wants to be, like, the decimal point bomber.
Yeah.
Maybe it's part of his aesthetic or something. I mean, who knows?
Because, you know, I mentioned Pelham 123. They wanted $1 million. Just
nice,
a million.
Nice, even chunk, yeah.
Then go in for these extra couple of hundred grand.
Yeah, I mean, you could be a can start adding like pennies and, you know, dollars and hundreds of thousands. You know what I mean? Like
making it pay $3,775,463.25.
I want you to pay me pi to the 10th power.
There you go.
What? That's not possible, sir. No rounding.
So Jack and Harry use the building access panels to examine the bomb. The SWAT team's Harry's the SWAT team bomb expert, says he doesn't look familiar, but the bomber is definitely a pro. While they wait, Harry quizzes Jack. Jack is in an airport when he sees a woman taken as hostage. The kidnapper is almost to the plane. What do you do? Well, you shoot the hostage, right? That right there reminded me never to be in a hostage situation with Keanu Reeves.
Right? Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But, yeah, I'm suing him, definitely. It's intentionally shot. He premeditated, man. I got it on tape.
Right. Well, Jack suddenly comes with an idea to use a window cleaner's crane on the roof as a way to hopefully get the passengers off the rigged car. However, the bomber has bugged the express elevator and is listening to everything the pair are saying and doing. Suspecting something is up, he blows the emergency brakes and the elevator begins to plummet. Uh-oh. Mm. The crane cable stops the elevator for a short time between two floors, where Harry and Jack manage to get the passengers unloaded before the crane pulls free of its base and the elevator plummets to the bottom. Harry noticed the explosion happened 3 minutes earlier than the timeline was given. Jack suggests that the bomber is nearby, while Harry tells him the bomber could have set off the charges from miles away. But Harry suggests the bomber will want to stay mobile. With the main elevators having been shut down, Jack deduces that the bomber must be aboard a freight elevator. See detective work.
Yeah, actual deduction and reasoning and stuff like that. And then actually talking to another person and sharing their professional opinions and perspectives and then coming to a decision. Yeah, real detective work. Bravo. Yeah.
And not only that, they both give the look freight elevators and they look at each other and it's like, uh-oh. You know?
Because they realize that's got to be it.
Yeah. So, Harry and Jack soon find the freight elevator and they try to get him, but he's also bugged the outside of the freight car and hears them coming. The bomber starts shooting them with the shotgun. Harry drops into the elevator car. He uses the control device wired to the control panel to raise the car to the top of the building, forcing Jack to jump into the elevator car before he's squashed by the roof. The bomber is about to shoot Jack square in the face with a shotgun, but he's out of ammo.
Wow. Stroke of luck there, yeah.
Yes. Especially with the shotgun, too.
Yeah, you can't just get wheeled into the hospital and get stitched up for that one.
No. There's a movie called Wild at Heart with Nicolas Cage in it, and they show a dude getting his head shot with a shotgun. Oh, that's never left me. Even though it was visual effects, it still never left me, the damage that was done.
Yeah. There's a couple of them out there that were kind of jarring and very memorable, definitely. Yeah, I know that feeling.
Well, the bomber quickly shows that he's wired himself with explosive and holds Harry hostage before Jack can get a clean shot of him. He uses the device to try and trick Harry and Jack's team into thinking they're getting off on a different floor, but they arrive at the parking level instead. The bomber attempts to take Harry with him to use the building's parking garage. But Jack, guess what he does? He shoots the hostage. Yep. Smart move.
Yep.
So Harry can't go any further, and the bomber drops him and makes a dash for the door, and explosives go off, knocking him back. So that's a good start. That's a good start to the movie right there.
Yeah, lots of action straight out of the gate, and there's no real exposition. So all you really know is here's this guy, and he's clearly the bad guy, and these guys are trying to stop him. So clearly they're the good guys. So you just get to sit back and enjoy this nice little piece of cinema to open it up.
Yeah, and not only that, right? Everything comes off somewhat logical. Fanciful, maybe, but there's logic to everything that everybody does in this whole thing.
It's based around regular detective / police work, like what they would have probably done in that situation for the most part. So yeah, so it's
except maybe shooting the hostage.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe maybe not that, but I mean, as far as the deduction and the reasoning and stuff like that, and knowing kind of understanding who they were dealing with, they knew he was a pro. So they knew that he was going to try various methods and stuff like that. So,
yeah. Well, sometime afterwards, there's a commendation ceremony is held, which Jack and Harry are congratulated for their services and are given medals of their valor for saving the hostages and stopping the bomber. Harry is promoted to detective and put on desk duty until his injured leg heals. The pair go to a bar where their colleagues celebrate the victory, but Harry tells Jack to be more cautious in his work because his recklessness could get him killed.
It's a little ironic foreshadowing.
Foreshadowing. Next day, Jack stops into a small coffee shop to get some coffee. As he goes up to his car, a bus is pulled away, explodes, and bursts into flames. Payphone nearby rings, and Jack is surprised to hear the bomber's voice on the line. The bomber's explained that he spent 2 years playing the elevator job and chastises Jack for ruining his life's work. So the guy's a little out there.
Out for some kind of compensation, some type of revenge. He feels like he's got to pay something back in the negative that he received.
So, the bomber goes on to explain that he's planted another bomb on an LA City bus, which has been armed at the moment the bus passes 50 miles an hour, and then will detonate if the bomb drops below that speed.
See, that's that right there, not to interrupt, but that right there is what sold this movie.
Yes.
That was the plot point, like it's a plot point, but it's also a device that they added. That, because if you look at the original one, it was 25 or whatever.
But 50 is 50.
Yeah, that changes a lot of things.
And you've
because
seen,
that limits where you can go, how much you can turn. Because you can't really turn a bus that much doing 50, dude.
Yeah.
Like, you can't at all. I mean, it's so top heavy. I mean.
Well, not just that. You don't see a bus going over 50 anyway.
Not often, no. But, no. I mean, you got to drive straight, essentially.
Yeah.
So you have to plan for a really straight pathway. Yeah, so that's pretty diabolical, man. I mean, wow. And plus with gas today, whew, man, expensive.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll get to the gas situation here in a minute.
Oh, yeah.
But the bomber explains that if any passengers are removed from the bus, he will blow the bus up and demands a ransom of $3.7 million, the same amount he made in the elevator kidnapping. So you know it's the same guy.
He must owe a guy $3.7 million. Like, he must owe, like, 3 mil, and he just wants 0.7 mil, just, like, go to Aruba and just pass out under an umbrella with a martini in his hand or something. Like, that must be it. Like,
it's like when you see a bill from, like, a doctor's office or something, you got to get those extra 75 cents in there somehow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's like, how do you come up with that number? Just, like, round it up to the nearest dollar. I mean, you know,
I got to pay my warlord and my my crime accountant, you know, and all those people. So
that's what the saving is for. The saving is for the IRS.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Criminal tax or whatever it is. Yeah.
So he demands the ransom of $3.7 million by 11 a.m. And furthermore, he knows the bus radio is out of order, so alerting the transit authority is useless. The bomber gives the bus number 2525, and Jack takes off to catch it.
So he doesn't say anything about getting on the bus.
No, just says anybody
it's just getting off of the bus. So if he gets on the bus, he is part of that until end, essentially.
Yeah. Jack manages to catch up to the bus en route, but is frantically tries to get the bus driver to open the doors. The driver ignores him, thinking it's just a prank. Jack comedy is a Jaguar and again catches up to the bus. After a mad struggle, Jack manages to relay to the driver that there is a bomb on the bus and manages to get on board. Jump from the moving car into the bus's door. I love that sequence.
Yeah.
The poor guy who spent his life savings on that car. Are you insured? Yeah. Why? And then he just, like, breaks and smashes the door off.
Yep. I mean, you're insured, dude. I mean, that's why you pay all that money.
Oh, sh**.
Commandeering is covered under something different by, I think it's either local or state. There's some kind of, like, allowance or protection for you or some kind of thing like that. So,
like a good neighbor, State Farm has to be there in that situation.
Yeah, right.
Jumps on the bus. Harry is also alerted through Jack by the Jaguar owner's cell phone. So he commandeers the car and takes the cell phone, which is another line I love. Can I take this? Fine, take the phone.
Yeah, it's that was kind of a luxury item back then.
Yeah,
like really only quote unquote important people with a lot of money had phones, and the car phones were kind of common too. I don't really see them much now. There's really no point to one.
No, you know, I mean, considering now all all cars made after a certain day have got like touchscreen panels and Bluetooth for
yourself. CarPlay or USB link up. Yeah, mine, it just connects automatically. I can make a call on it. Yeah, so I mean, most of them have got that. Or if not, you can like they even have like the tape deck thing with Bluetooth. Like there's all the kinds of different ways you can make it happen. So,
but back then, cell phones were not that common. That's why he didn't. That's why he drove away, catching up with everybody, and not called someone on his cell phone. Now, my question is, why didn't he call 911, say who he was, and get a police escort out to that bus and stop it before it went over 50?
Maybe because he thought it would take too long.
Yeah.
I mean, they're in a big city, or they're in L.A.?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to L.A., but...
It's huge.
Sometimes getting from one side of town to the other can take hours.
Yeah, that's true.
Depending on the traffic situation or construction. I believe I've heard them say the 10. It's not 10. It's the 10. That's the one that's always the problem, apparently, because it's either under construction or it's gridlocked. I would say it was probably just a logistics thing. Maybe he just thought he could get there quicker. But although that's not a bad idea either, man.
Yeah. Well, he calls Harry, and Harry's like, look, I drug my hungover ass into work today, and you better show up too. He's like, no, Harry, he's alive. And that sobers Harry up real, real quickly.
Yeah, he's full of adrenaline, and Harry gets a little injection of that too once he tells him that short phrase. That's all it took. He didn't have to say who. He said he, and that perked him right up. Yeah.
Yeah. So Jack attempts to calm the bus passengers, but an altercation with one man wielding a gun, fearing that Jack has come to arrest him, forces a struggle, and the bus driver is shot. So. Yep. That's already a good obstacle to put in the way. Now you've got the driver, the most experienced person in the vehicle.
Yeah, I was going to say the most qualified person to do that job is now unavailable and fighting for their life. Yeah.
Yes. So the young woman named Annie Porter, who takes the wheel and planned to hit the brake, Jack sharply orders her to not stop the bus and informs the passengers about the bomb. At the suggestion of the injured driver, Jack opens an access panel on the bus floor and finds a decoy, and then the real bomb, which is an alarmingly large. Relaying the info to Harry, Harry's perplexed at Jack's observation that the timer for the bomb is a cheap gold watch. Harry's suspicion turns to the prospect that their mad bomber may be a former officer, and has his staff looking over information about officers who work with bombs or on bomb squads.
That was sloppy by our guy to do that, to put that watch on there.
You think it's sloppy.
It was showboating, in a way.
Yes, because
he thought he was going to get away with it, and it was going to be destroyed. It wasn't going to matter.
Well, one of the things, on the one hand, it looked sloppy, but on the other hand, he wanted them to know who he was at the same time. And we'll get to that here in a little while, because he does say, you know, after a certain point of the movie, he said, I think a large neon sign with the word Howard Payne written on it would have been a little too obvious. So he wanted them to find them.
Yeah, and there's another remark about the watch too, in dialogue later on. Yeah, that's true, man. That's a really good point.
Yeah, back on the bus, a traffic jam on the freeway forces Annie to divert the bus onto the city streets. There, the LAPD with an LAPD helicopter following the bus and McMahon on board trying to arrange a survivable route. The occupants of the bus have a terrifying ordeal as Jack and Annie must deal with every conceivable obstacle that threatens to fatally slow the bus and is forced to careen through the streets. These include being forced to take a one-way lane against opposing traffic, a collision with a baby carriage that's sent flying but is only carrying cans. Now, that could have killed it.
She acted like it was a baby, though.
Yes.
Which kind of messed my head a little bit. I had to rewind. I was like, it was cans? Okay. It was cans. Because she was very animated about that. But, I mean, if that was all your food, I guess I would be equally mad, too.
So. Yes. I mean, that right there, I mean, they played that up really, really well, that it was going to be a baby. Because they stopped the dramatic music, because like it had the theme going, and then as soon as you see the lady pushing the buggy for the first time, silence. You just hear the natural ambient sound, and the woman talking to another woman, she's about to leave, and then the music doesn't pick up until like after she's done flailing around, Sandra Bullock's done flailing her arms around, and almost set the bus back down to 30.
Right. It was kind of an early version of the trolley car dilemma.
Yes.
Because, I mean, you slam on the brakes and you save the baby, but everybody else blows up.
You wouldn't even save the baby.
No, but I'm saying, but they think it's a baby. Yeah. So to them, that's what they are doing.
Well, the explosion would have killed it, though.
Yeah, true.
True.
But, I mean, it's like, I don't know. It just kind of reminded me of that whole thing. Like, who do you save? Yeah, it's, yeah. So that's, it was smarter than to pop that in there, because that made it really tense. Had a lot of tense, you know, feelings to that scene.
And I think it also emphasized the seriousness of the situation even more.
Absolutely, yeah, because there's other people not involved in the on the bus directly that were still going to be affected by it. People outside, people unknowing of what was going on.
Yeah. So let's just see what happened here. The police eventually escort a police escort arrives and guides the bus to the unfinished and empty 105 freeway. The first entrance is a soft turn right, blocked by a group of school kids crossing at the worst possible time, and Annie and Jack are forced to make a hard right turn and nearly spill the bus on its side. I love that line. It's going to be an ugly turn, though, and it's like, that's not a turn, that's a dead end. So what they do is they get everybody on the same side of the bus so they can weigh it down so they can make this turn.
Gotcha.
We're going to tip over. Yeah. Right. We're going to tip over. Just like the urgency in their voices, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I think Home Dude from Ferris Bueller was kind of the ringleader for that one. I think he did a good job on that, of really showing what they were all kind of feeling. They all did in their own way, but I think he was kind of like the ringleader of all that, really.
Once on the freeway, McMahon and a number of officers board a flatbed truck that pulls up next to the bus. McMahon wants to get everybody off the bus, but Jack explains that the news helicopters in the air are televising the event and that the bomber will detonate the bus if anyone gets off.
Yep.
So, you know, he said, don't take anyone off the bus. And the press, being the press and the news media, let's go follow this bus.
Yeah, post-OJ. You know, every reality TV, you know, it's like, ooh, something's happening. Get every helicopter in the world.
This was pre OJ.
Okay, well,
because OJ didn't happen until '95, right? I think.
Yeah, you're right. You're right about that. But anyways, we were always hungry for like live events in the '90s, because the news was still big. Live TV was still big, because we really didn't have big internet, so there was no like, you know, live on Facebook or anything like that.
This wasn't trending on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. So if anything was happening that was cool or like noteworthy, it would happen and we'd see it on the news.
Nice. They'd cut into everybody. They're making me miss Mario, you know.
Oh yeah, they'd interrupt anything and just tell you some stuff. It's like, well, okay. Do we really have to interrupt the end of Power Rangers for that one? Okay.
Oh, they're bringing Power Rangers back. Only bringing four of them back for some reason.
Oh, okay.
But and it's like the original cast for the American version.
Oh, okay, cool.
So like they're all in their 40s now, and they're all paying mortgages, and you know,
like need bacchiotomies and stuff.
What do you mean your knees are broken? Jackson receives a call from the bomber in regards to what's being seen on the television. He manages to get the bomber to agree to let the wounded bus driver off, although the bomber tells Jack that the wildcat behind the wheel best not slow down. The driver is taken off successfully, however a passenger named Helen gets edgy and attempts to get off the bus herself. As she stands over the entranceway stairs, the bomber sets off a smaller charge to destroy the platform, and Helen falls under the wheels and is crushed. That right there, I thought that was the explosion when I first saw it.
I mean, it was within the confines of the rules that he set forth in the beginning. I mean, he said that was it if anybody got off. So, yeah, I was right there with you. First watch, I was like, why?
That kind of left the main character?
Yeah, this quickly, what is this, burn after reading? You know?
Yeah. During a few moments of relative calm, Annie clearly confesses to Jack that she was relieved that the blast was not from the main bomb and she survived. Jack, she was Annie, that's a perfectly normal response. And
survivor, little survivor guilt there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
The real person to blame is the bomber, because he put us in this situation. Remember, it's his fault.
That's true. I mean, even though he was like, he said it like, whoa, like it's serious. I mean, he's right about that. I mean, it's not it's not anyone's fault but the guy that put them in the situation.
Now, they coined a phrase that I love. They said that the guy is crazy, not stupid.
Yeah.
And they bring that up several times.
Not mutually exclusive. They can be, but they're not mutually exclusive.
Like Forrest Gump. Oh, I got some that.
Get the Arthur Fist meme ready.
All right, definitely. So McMahon is then informed that the 105 freeway is unfinished and the stretch of roadway contains a 50-foot gap.
You should have thought of that ahead of time, right? You know?
Yeah. Jack is informed, but the bus still refuses to take any passengers off. Desperately, Jack then instructs Annie to increase the speed, figuring there may be an incline that will allow them to jump the bus over the gap. Miraculously, his plan works and the bus makes it to the other side intact.
Miraculously is the key phrase there. Like, by the hair on their chinny chin chins, defying all logic and physics and general understanding of something going through the air with that kind of mass, the kind of velocity that it would actually have to have. And then the amount of force coming down with that kind of mass going in that speed. Yeah, it'd have been totally fine.
The only thing that was missing was a wooden ramp for them to jump off of.
I mean, just add in a flip and put some sharks under them. I mean, ring of fire. I mean,
it's no, evil it was
yeah, right. It was really well shot, but yeah, this there's some. I mean, I was rewatching it. Like, there's a shot where it looks like it gets lifted up in the air, like it gets zhushed up somehow, and yeah, just that. That thing, I mean, they can't see us, but, like, literally that gap, like, that bus would have just been, like, hot dog style, just like, that would have been it, man.
It would have nosedived.
Yeah, miraculously is the phrase there, dude. Like, Jesus Christ himself must have picked them up and carried them over that thing. Like, Jesus, that was incredible.
Jesus, take the wheel. No, the steering wheel.
Literally.
The steering wheel, not that wheel. Once over, Jack finds an off-ramp that leads to LAX. Annie takes it and enters through an airport exit, running over a pair of spikes that blow a few of the tires. Jack's plan is to keep the news helicopter's camera from following them because the airport is restricted airspace. Smart move.
Yep, that takes the media and the extra eyes that obviously this guy is going to be using to his advantage because, I mean, it's all there and accessible, right? So, yeah, it's very smart.
And not only that, the long runways that are not being used give them enough space so they can just keep circling.
But yeah, because 50 miles an hour is very slow for a plane.
Yes.
So they have, most airports are designed, they have gentle turns and curves that are designed to go like 50 to 75 miles an hour. So yeah, that's the perfect plan.
Yes, so now,
as long as there's not a huge freaking gap somewhere.
Right. that's actually, they say that in the movie. They say he's taking him to the airport. Well, let's hope the runway's built.
Yeah, I know, right? Exactly. That'd have been funny if they got there. It's like, again?
Oh, goodness me. Lieutenant McMahon shows up at the airport with some more cops, and Jack convinces the bomber to let him disembark to negotiate the ransom, which the bomber initially doesn't want to do, but Jack getting on the bus and getting off again is within the rules.
No one from the original bus got off.
So Jack.
So yeah, I agree with that, and I think it was probably in the bomber's best interest to allow that too, if he wanted to actually get the wheels turning on his payment.
Yep.
So there you go.
So Jack gets off the bus and onto a vehicle with Lieutenant McMahon, who feels that they should be able to unload the passengers safely, but Jack is still convinced somehow that the bomber will know. Leave him one option. Disarm the bomb.
Yeah. One of the coolest parts of the whole movie, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Jack goes onto a small wheel dolly attached to a cable to a small truck and is sent under the still-moving bus. Now, that right there...
Dude.
I sent you a GIF the other day of Randy Marsh in a wheelbarrow with his nuts hanging out of it, just carrying them. That's what Jack Travis had in that point right there.
And they actually signified that Ortiz actually said that, it just said that, and he said it was clever how they said it because they used slang like Hawaiian slang.
Yes.
But it actually became a part of the lexicon of 90s verbiage.
Yes. You had some big cojones.
Exactly, dude. That became a thing that said, that meant like, dude, you are brave. Like, you are very brave. So yeah, the little tiny wheels on it and stuff. Yeah, oh, dude, there's so much could go wrong. Like, any little imperfection at that speed. Ooh, yeah, I'm telling you, you're right about that.
So he tries to dismantle it with the help from Harry and the bomb squad. However, the bombers fitted the bomb with what they call a collapsible circuit, and Jack is unable to disarm it. The collapsible circuit means if you try and mess with it, it's going to blow up anyway.
The circuits are built on each other.
Yes.
So a lot of the movies, you see that this is another classic scenario. You have the three wires or the series of wires.
Yes.
You've got to cut the correct one. This would be a situation where, say, okay, I know it's the green wire. We cut the green wire, it goes off anyways because everything is parallel circuited back to one another.
Yeah.
So that's this guy's good. He had a decoy. He had a smaller bomb, and now he's got another protection in place on his actual bomb in the event that he could get to it. So, yeah, this guy, he's been pretty much one step ahead of him every step of the way so far.
Crazy, not stupid.
Exactly.
So, Harry's still thinking of alternative ways to disarm the bomb when they find out the bomber's identity, Howard Payne.
Yeah.
Payne turns out to be a former member of the Atlanta PD's bomb squad who was forced into early retirement when a bomb he was disarming explodes, burning his hand and costing him a thumb.
So, yeah, he was looking for some revenge, certainly.
So, Harry and his associates run off to apprehend Howard. However, Jack comes close to death when the cable towing the dollies on gives way and he's almost run over by the bus. Jack clings to the undercarriage of the bus and accidentally punctures the fuel tank with a screwdriver. Uh-oh.
Yep.
We've got a problem now.
Yeah, now we got a leak that's not going to help anything. And a gas guzzler at that, too.
Oh, yeah. The passengers on the bus help Jack through an access panel on the bus's floor, and he survives. With leaking fuel, Jack calls for a fueling vehicle and the bus to be refueled. Meanwhile, Harry and some other members of the LAPD SWAT team that weren't at the airport have staked at Howard Payne's house. They soon find that he's not there and that he's booby-trapped the house with explosives, the trigger upon entry. Kills everybody inside, including Harry.
Yeah, this guy is not messing around. Like he, like I said just seconds ago, like he's covering all his bases. He's thinking of, he knows, you know, obviously because he was in the bomb squad, he's got police training, you know, and he's got specialized training with weapons and bombs and stuff like that. And he's putting all of these things, all these knowledge and skills, all to use. It's literally, he was talking about a lifetime of work. You know, 2 years planning something is only 2 years, but I get what he's saying now. Like a lifetime, like he's been studying this stuff and doing this stuff his entire life.
Yeah.
So that totally makes sense. He's not messing around at all. Totally.
No. As the bomb goes off, Payne calls Jack and gloats over Harry's death and saying it was his old watch that helped Harry identify him. Payne gives Jack instructions to deliver the $3.7 million ransom to a garbage can at Pershing Street downtown, mentioning that everyone on the bus will die if he doesn't get his money. Again, referring to Annie as a wildcat.
Another tell. It's like almost he was showboating, man. I really, you know what I mean? It's kind of like how like serial killers are known to take like mementos.
Yes.
To like keep little things. It's almost like a version of that. Like he's holding the ball up in the air as he runs in for a touchdown. He's shaking his hips and dancing. You know what I mean? Because he knows he's going in there clean. He's got it. Yeah.
He's
you
doing
know,
that
doing
thing.
A wheelie. Wah, you know, like that.
He's doing the thing, putting a hand on the kid's head while the kid's swinging for him. And he can't, touch this. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Jack has a meltdown over Harry's death and is unsure what to do next, accepting the pain might win. Then he notices that the sweatshirt Annie's been wearing contains the logo for the University of Arizona Wildcats.
Yeah, I love that. I love that reference because that was where I grew up, and I used to go to their hockey games and football and basketball games all the time. So, U of A, what's up?
That's all well and good. Thing is, the logo, you can't see it. The logo is like this big, though.
Yeah.
How could he see a black logo that's less than 2 inches thing on a gray shirt when, as we find out, the equipment that he's using to spy on the bus, which he is doing, is black and white?
Well, that's where the science fiction portion of this movie kicks in. Because, I mean, If you break down the camera and all the CCTV, the feed, all the elements that are present there, none of that was possible back then.
No,
it was impossible. You could not have a roaming CCTV connection in a city as huge as Los Angeles without some type of like TV broadcasting equipment. I mean, you would need a whole nother section of the bus to be able to.
Yeah.
There's no like getting a little thing and popping it up there discreetly and then hooking it up to internet. I mean, that wasn't a thing. Like, it's just. So it didn't bother me so much as a kid. I was like part of the movie, the suspension of disbelief. But now I'm like, that's just totally not feasible. So
it did have a limitation. It couldn't record audio. So.
But it could stream, like it could stream, like I mean, video from a moving vehicle.
Yeah.
And Los Angeles County, which has 8 million people, it's like 350 square. I don't know what it is. It's huge. It's a huge chunk of land. Nah, man. He didn't have the money or the technology. Or was there like a huge like satellite dish on top of the bus that we didn't see? I mean, like, yeah,
because it would have to have a Swedish satellite dish on top of the bus to do any of that.
It would have had to have like the broadcasting. You remember when they would go remote and they'd have those vans that have the big old they'd have to have one of those, dude. And it wouldn't even be perfect, you know. It would be really rough. So, anyways,
but this proves to be the Achilles heel.
Yeah, he showboated a little too hard, and somebody knocked the ball out of his hand right before he got to the end zone.
Because Jack radios over to McMahon his plan. McMahon gets all the news companies nearby to stop taping, and Comedy is wanted to find the signal going to the bus camera. With everyone sitting still on the bus, the news team records them, gathering enough footage to run a loop long enough to fool Payne. However, Annie notices the fuel is almost empty. McMahon is forced to have the tape loop with only a minute of footage having been recorded. But if they're everybody sitting still and just staring at that, you know, staring ahead, that's enough. Because he wasn't like staring completely at the monitor the whole time. He was watching like two football games, you know, in his lair with the Coca-Cola. He wasn't paying attention to the bus. Only when, you know, the helicopters notice there's a flatbed truck, let's look at the bus. Oh, you can't do that. Let me call them, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So an airport bus is brought alongside 225, and the bus is unloaded. However, the tires that have been punched on the bus went through the airport's exit and continues to lose their treads. Annie and Jack are unable to get off. Jack fixes the steering wheel with some rope on the gas pedal with a steel pipe, and the two escape under the bus on an access panel.
Nope.
Uh-uh. Not buying happened. It.
Yeah, and his cojones doubled right there once again. And so did hers. I mean, I know it's figurative, but like, women can be brave like that too. They deserve to have cojones as well. So Sandra Bullock's character gets cojones there.
There you go. The bus drives away off before heading straight into an empty cargo plane. As the speed drops to 50 miles an hour, the bus crashes into the plane and it explodes.
Boom.
Can you imagine the cost the LAPD would have to pay to replace a FedEx plane?
Oh, yeah. I mean, those planes are millions and millions of dollars, those big ones.
It's like $4 million a plane.
Yeah, it's something ridiculous like that. I think that's stripped down, too. That's not even branded or equipped or anything like that.
There you go. After the passengers are treated by paramedics, the police receive a phone call from Payne wanting to know where his money is. McMahon is about to tell Payne off, but Jack realizes that Payne doesn't know the bus has exploded, giving them an advantage to capture the madman. Now, when the bus exploded, that should have got rid of the camera feed, right?
Who knows, man, with the kind of technology, the alien, like, 2012 technology they had somehow. Who knows, man? Yeah, I mean, in theory, you think it would have just gone to, like it does in most movies, but who knows?
For those interested, Wi-Fi and wireless internet was not invented until, like, 2002, 2004, in that time period.
And it wasn't really commercially available until a couple years later after that.
And it was about as reliable as... Well, it wasn't reliable.
It was
terrible.
Yeah, it was a joke compared to what it is now, definitely. It was somewhat of a marvel. I think we tolerated it because it was a marvel.
Yeah.
But now it's like we use it as a utility now. It's like, nah, it just needs to be better.
All right. While the money is placed in bags and dropped into the garbage container, the Payne specialized. However, there are paint bombs in the cache. A number of officers using the Parishion Square with Payne watching from an overhead building. Payne thinks he's won, and then he notices the bus camera and realizes the tape is on a loop.
Yep.
Payne quickly puts on his old police uniform and blends in with the other officers and walks over to Annie and escorts her away from the scene, saying that he's been sent by Jack. Now, why would you take a civilian to a scene like that?
I don't know.
Reasons of plot, aside
from
that.
Just to... that's the only thing I can think of, just to move it forward somehow, just to add another layer to it, you know?
Well, she's a state's witness, so we got to protect her. I know. Let's take her right to the house where the madman lives.
Boom. Perfect.
Jack and a number of officers wait for the garbage can, but no one has appeared. Jack immediately demands they turn on the Holman beacon with the money, and they're all surprised to see that the money is in motion. Jack rushes the garbage can and finds that there's a hole below it, and in the pavement leading down to the street is a level under it. Jack,
see, one step ahead every time, man. I'm telling you.
Jack drops through the hole below street level and is confronted with Annie strapped with explosives and Payne standing nearby holding a detonator. Payne chastises Jack a bit before making his way to the Los Angeles subway system. Jack jumping aboard as it pulls away. Crawling across the top, Payne handcuffs Annie to a pole and shoots and kills the train driver. Payne then explains his plan to Annie. He intends to get off the train with the money, but leave her unexplored, leading the police to think they both died in the subway.
Yeah.
Crazy, not stupid.
Yep.
However, Payne's overzealous nature gets the better of him and he hears Jack climbing on top of the train car. Playfully, he claims he might be able to bribe Jack into letting him go, and as he reaches into the sack of money, it sets off the hidden dye pack bomb, ruining the money and covering him in purple dye. Payne then climbs up to the side of the train car. Earlier on, it had realism in the elevator scene, but the train scene is complete fantasy.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
He climbs up the train on the outside and goes head-to-head with Jack. As they fight, Jack notices a low-hanging light approaching and holds Payne's head up to it while seizing the detonator, Annie. The light decapitates Payne and his body falls off the car, leaving no blood.
No. Clean, clean, perfect
clean
head
as a whistle.
Chop off. That was it.
That wouldn't have happened.
No, it was still... Like, I don't wish anyone death, but just like in the whole scheme of things, like that was just kind of a satisfying moment after all the carnage he'd caused to all these people and whatnot and all the destruction.
Goodness me. Then Jack enters the train car and manages to get the explosives off Annie. However, he does not have the key to unlock the handcuffs. And when Payne shot the train driver, some stray bullets hit the control panel, rendering the brakes inoperable. A rail map shows Jack there's a sharp curve ahead. He speeds up the train with the intention of derailing it, and the plan works as Annie's freed from the bar. The train barrels out of an incomplete stretch of track right in front of the Chinese Theater in Hollywood. It sits and lands on its side and comes to the halt. None of the workers on the subway tunnel are hurt, and Annie and Jack are both alive, and they kiss. Aww. Oh,
now it's a love story.
A number of tourists and others whom the train has stopped for come over to look at the strange spectacle, and that is Speed.
Yeah, man, it's a lot. It's a dense movie. There's a lot going on in it.
And it's surprisingly dense for the content of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like a simple premise: a bomb's on a bus. You can't slow down, or it'll explode. But then it adds so many different wrinkles into it.
Yeah, it had little caveats, and you know, by adding the fact that it was a retired cop, that adds another twist, Shyamalan.
So it goes from the bus driver shot, the woman tries to get off the bus and the bus nearly blows up, the hard right turn, the 50-foot gap.
The train... Her being stuck in the train and the derailing the train. Yeah, there's so many. Yeah, it's a lot.
So, Sandra Bullock, Jeff Daniels, and Keanu Reeves all train with professionals to learn their parts for the movie. So, Sandra Bullock actually knows how to drive a bus.
Huh.
So, and then you
got... She looked like she was driving it. It wouldn't surprise me at all, honestly.
The idea to jump the bus came from a director, Jan DeBart, noticing a segment of highway missing while shooting. So as they were shooting, they noticed that that piece was missing, so they wrote it into the script and added it at the last minute.
Wow, that's awesome.
The film went over budget before the final scene, so the train sequence was almost cut completely. Mm. I guess he would have got the money and they would have riddled him with bullets and that would have been end of movie.
Oh, that's lame.
That's lame. Test screenings, it was storyboard animation with voiceover until the final scene was a huge success. So the studio came up with more money to shoot the final scene.
Wow. Okay.
In choosing Dennis Hopper, they wanted an ordinary man who just snapped one day. And you mentioned OJ earlier. It's actually released a week before the OJ Bronco chase.
Okay, wow. So they're almost like in harmony with each other.
Yes.
Oh, speaking of an ordinary man who just snapped one day, Michael Douglas from Falling Down.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I think Michael Douglas might have been able to pull off this role if you were going to cast an alternate Payne. Yeah, I think he, because he was incredible in that. And yeah, so.
He scared. He genuinely scared me in that movie.
Oh, yeah. And that's literally how I always, since. When someone's like, hey, what's that movie about? Oh, just a normal guy who just lost his mind one day.
There you go.
Just the stress of the world just got to him. Yeah.
This film was supposed to release after True Lies, but because of the success of the test screenings, they kind of put it on before True Lies. I love True Lies. It's a real, real good movie.
Fantastic. Very good. Good. One of those complete movies. A little bit of everything in it.
Yes. Yes, yes. The mugshots that the police used to track Howard Payne are actually the cast and the crew. So you might get to see Keanu Reeves' mugshot in there. Let's see. To create the iconic jump scene, they created a special bus with better suspension and the ability to go 70 miles an hour cleanly with the driver's seat 15 feet back in the bus. This is how they did it, folks. They digitally removed the highway in post-production. Okay. And they had the special bus jump off a ramp.
I see that, and I mentioned that earlier, that it looked like it was getting moved up somehow, so I guess it was the studio magic with them using the ramp and then removing everything else with computers or rocks and sticks or whatever they were doing back in the 90s.
Yeah, so to me, this is a 9 out of 10 movie, because even though the imperfections in the later half of the movie are there, it's still a real, real fun movie to sit down and watch. You just gotta turn your brain partially off and buy into that universe.
Yeah, I mean there's elements like that make a movie a good movie, like, and that's the whole point of going to plays and movies and stuff like that, because it lets you be kind of in a different world for a little while. So yeah, I think they there's actual real life stuff in it too, and there's a little bit of they took some liberties here and there, but I mean, like I said, that's just movies for you. But yeah, man, I would give this a 9 based on that, because it's still good to watch. It's just well done. It's good for people that have ADD, because it moves. And it keeps your interest. So yeah, it's well done. The subsequent ones were nowhere near as good as it, but yeah, it was excellent. 9 out of 10.
Well, if you want to watch this movie, it is on all streaming platforms like Hulu and Amazon Prime and Tubi, and you can rent it from YouTube, Google Play, Redbox for a minimum amount of money. So that's if you want to watch this movie. It's really, really good.
On tape. I still have my tape.
I wore my tape out. I taped it off the TV. So.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, mine's worse for wear. It's a legit like store bought copy, but it's probably been screened at least 100 times. I love that movie.
Well, the film's dialogue invented the 90s pop culture. You know, the crazy not stupid line,
yep.
Pop quiz hot shot,
cojones.
I still say that cojones. Yeah.
Yep.
The film has been referenced in all sorts of TVs and movies since its release. The Simpsons Sonic the Hedgehog parodied it, and the Irish comedy Father Ted, did a whole episode called Speed 3,
uh-huh.
where they have a milk float. That if it goes over 3 miles an hour, a bomb is armed. That if it goes under 3 miles an hour, the bomb explodes.
Nice. This next one's the one I remember the most.
Speed 2.
The Mythbusters one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was busted by Mythbusters.
Yeah.
Every time the bus fell off the track.
That's what I'm saying. Because, okay, like, there's a lot of weight on the top of buses, but also in the front.
Yeah.
So a thing is just going to sink like a stone end over end. It's just going to, like, whoop. Like, I mean, unless you get some kind of thrust upward. And some major thrust upward. Yeah, that ain't happening.
It ain't happening, especially with the engine at the front of the bus.
That's what I'm saying. You can put as many dudes as you want perfectly throughout there, and that engine and the top heaviness is gonna, it's gonna go forward and then start spinning. The top is gonna get pulled down. Yeah, it's gonna be a mess.
And that, my friends, is Speed.
Yeah.
So, what do you think of Speed? Why don't you let us know on our social media pages? You know, we have them for a reason. Go ahead and check them out. Go and like, share, and subscribe, everybody.
Annihilate the button of liking.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Or
whatever the cool kids say.
Yes. Whatever the youth say these days.
Hello, fellow kids.
Yes. It is I, your 39-year-old friend.
Yes, I'm hip. I'm with it.
Tucker, Tucker. You know what's sad? We're referencing a 30-year-old movie just to get that reference out there.
Oh, boy. We're streets behind, man.
It's like that scene from The Simpsons, isn't it? I was with it. I was hip. Now I don't know what it is. It'll happen to you.
It'll happen to you. Yes. Yeah, that's the most chilling part of it, because it gets truer every single day.
Yes, it does. So, Greg, man, it's been great to have you on. You'll be back next week talking about Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah, I'm going to study up for that one by playing a lot of it.
There you go. And I'll be back here in a couple of minutes to talk about some stuff that we've got going on. And that's my take my medicine alarm. So,
boom. Speaking of being young and vibrant, right?
Yeah. So, we're going to get off here. I'll be back in a couple of minutes. Greg will be back next week, and we'll see you soon.
Peace.
Sincere thank you to Greg Gregory for taking the time out of his busy day. I know he's got a lot going on, and I thank him for every time he comes on here, and I do appreciate his time. And yeah, it was good to have him on as we talked about Speed. Next week, Greg is back as we talk about another thing to do with Speed, only this time it's not a bus going 50 miles an hour. It's about a little blue hedgehog who goes the speed of sound. We start talking about Sonic the Hedgehog 1 through 3. It's going to be it's a fun episode. We spend a lot of time talking about music in there, which is really, really good. I love music. Music makes the world go round. Also, talking of video games and classic ones, we continue our playthrough of Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door over on our Twitch channel. That's twitch.tv/adadstreamer. It's twitch.tv/adadstreamer, okay? So, I want to get some more traffic over there. I appreciate everybody who's taking the time to watch it. We've gotten some good feedback, and I enjoy playing the game, and I enjoy spending time with you guys. It's the only thing I don't like is the cutscenes in between where you've got to do the thing with Peach and you've got to do the thing with Bowser. Yeah, that really, really annoys me that you have to do something like that in the middle of a game. So, anyway, it's part and parcel of the game. It's a palate cleanser, if you will. But, yeah, that's what we've got going on. So, we've got Greg next week with Sonic 2 and Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door. We still haven't decided on what we're doing about the 90s gamer yet, but I'll have an announcement on that one before this season of the 90s podcast is out, and I should have a new game available pretty soon, okay? And that is it. I really don't have anything to talk about, except the fact that you can find us in our archives at becausewemenetwork.com. Go check out Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for all the latest news and what's happenings. And don't forget to check out Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podchaser, Pandora, YouTube, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, Podbean, or Amazon Music. That's where you'll find this podcast, amongst the other podcasts that we do, especially if you listen to this on something that is not your regular podcast listen to. You know, just for example, you're browsing across Spotify one day and you come across us, but you usually get your podcast from Apple, you know, etc., etc. That's why I announce it everywhere that we're at, just so people are in the clear as to what we do. And that is it. I'm gonna go ahead and rest my voice because it's starting to get a little scratchy, but hope everybody takes it easy and has a good week. Have the week they deserve. If it's fun, great. If it's not fun, I'm sorry. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm rambling again. That's okay, though, because I know the magic words to end the episode now. I just don't know how to get there without rambling. So, yeah, that's me. So, take it easy, everybody. Have a good week. Bye.